Magic Without Fears, Hermetic Podcast. I'm your host, Frater RC. For more and exclusive episodes, visit magicwithoutfears.com. Thank you for your support.
Wayne's World.
There it is. And we are. We did it. Oh my God, dude. Can you believe we made it this far? You're finally opened up. You opened awesome. Up for Canada, man. It's crazy. If I just stayed in California, I could, you know.
But what was weird is when you were in California, you were actually feeling like the bits of the draconian lockdown that we were feeling, right? Like we both felt it because you were up north and when we came down and hung out, it was almost like sacrilegious that we could even hang out and talk, right?
But, yeah. And but it was good. Yeah, it's good that we got together a few times for sure.
Definitely.
It's like, you know, people hanging out here, but we're not supposed to go to houses yet. But I think things are changing. We'll see. Till round two, right?
We'll see.
Or
I mean,
three or four. Well,
yeah, definitely. I mean, you never know. Like for example, in our manufacturing, we've got factories in Malaysia that are now locked down. So different countries are feeling it at different times.
Yeah, just whatever you do on this episode tonight, don't say Taiwan.
Okay.
Yeah, don't, because Taiwan doesn't exist. Taiwan is like heaven. It's a place in your mind. You go there.
Utopia. Utopia.
Yeah. So hey, what's new in the library collection?
New with the library collection, we've got a few new volumes that came in recently. I finally got Jack Grail's Hecateon, which was amazing.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
What did you pay for that?
You know what? Like, there's 40? No. Here's the thing: is that many people are stuck on those first original printings, and they did another reprinting. In fact, I'm sure it's still around.
I didn't notice. I know they just did for Clavis Goetica for Frater Acker's thing.
Yes, that's another. Yeah. Interesting title.
I also read today. I read Daniel Harms' review of it, which is actually really interesting because Daniel Harms did the Book of Oberon with Skinner, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Harms did a review of the Goetica, and basically he criticizes a little bit of the myth making and some of the technical categorization of things. But other than that, he thought it was a good book, and it includes a new translation of a old manuscript, I believe from German at the Magical Library in Leipzig, which is where I was, of course, just a couple of years ago for some reason. And it was an amazing manuscript, and it's like written such a crazy handwriting that, yeah, I couldn't barely make out a few words. So good thing for someone to translate.
Yeah, no, Frater Archer is on fire, man. Archer Frater Acher, thank you. He's been producing things left and right. I mean, he just also launched Rosicrucian Magic. He's still doing his Quaria thing as well.
I just got that.
Yeah. I mean, amazing text. And he's been collaborating with one of my favorite artists. Second of Nature is one of his favorite books, or one of my favorite books, I'm sorry, which was, I'll have to bring
Gabriel.
Yeah, Gabriel Jose.
Yeah.
Amazing artist and perfect combination.
He's the same guy who did the new Pussifer album art.
Yes. Right? And that's what's so cool.
I talked
cool.
to him briefly. Yeah. I talked to him. He said he doesn't have a voice. His art isn't him talking on a podcast. So I was like, fucking fair enough, man. I love your art. I ordered one of his stickers of the album from Pussifer.com just so that I could put it on one of my notebooks.
I mean, of all artists right now in the occulty, I'm a total fanboy. It's like, my favorite.
They've got great stickers. Like in Canada, it was just like $3 for the sticker and $23 for shipping. So it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just joking. No, it sort of was. I got a hat too.
No, and that's another funny point too, is that even the most esoteric of artists are getting out there. I mean, because the pandemic opened everything up. I read an article the other day that during the pandemic, spirituality like soared to an all-time high. And you, like you just mentioned, how much did you pay for Hecateon? It's kind of funny. I've seen like every book in my library just like score in value. And it's Interesting.
Yeah, you, dude, as you know, I just actually sent a Canadian who's stuck in sort of Oregon, Saturn Creatrix. I just sent her the links to the 3 hours of us pouring over your video library. Well, we're sort of hammered.
Totally.
Because they're hidden on the IGTVs of my Esoteric Ebooks Instagram and my Fred RC Instagram. They're buried there, but they are there, and they're good stuff, because like we really looked at your library intensely, and that was for 3 hours while talking shit. So
it didn't even get through like all of it, right?
Oh god, no, it would have taken days. We definitely didn't have enough time to study and do ritual work, let alone music together, but that was the nature of the game down in COVID-fornia.
Yeah, I mean, the timing
seems like a lifetime ago.
But it'll be soon. We'll be hanging out. We'll play some music. We'll resume where we left off. It'll happen, man.
Yeah, so you did unload. You had a couple duplicates of some things that shot up way in value, and you unloaded them. Which were they?
You know, the only thing I let go in the whole library was the John D. 2 volume that was done by
the Kevin Kline. That's what I want.
It's a beautiful volume.
Hardcover.
I have plenty of copies of them. And when I brought it up to Larry over at Miskatonic Books, he was like, I want it, and I don't want it to sell it. I want it for my personal library. So I gave him a killer deal on it, because I figured it was just perfect.
That's nice of you.
Good for you. Yeah, no, totally. I mean, and who wants to deal with just, you know, random folks selling books unless that's your business? And I think that Larry does such an awesome job. Along with one of my other favorites is Anathema Publishing.
Yeah.
And they're on fire right now.
Oh, I haven't. What did they just do?
Okay, so he was already working with like Shani Oates and a lot of the other awesome sabbatic.
Are they doing Sam Davis's new book?
I'm not sure about that, but he just did a whole new pre-order. I think it's coming out next week, The Mesopotamian Mysteries. But what's cool about him is that he also sells Jose Gabriel's artwork in prints. He also works with my Haitian friend Leslie, amazing artist out there that runs a school. But on top of that, he just brought on Black Letter Press as a distributor. He also brought on a bunch of like black metal CDs, so they kind of match up with some of the work. So he's actually bringing something to the table, I think, that is different than a lot of cult publishers out there. You know, selling, you can get a black metal CD with artwork, and then you can buy different books from him. So he's definitely coming at it with a different angle, and they seem to be growing quite largely despite the pandemic setbacks.
Yeah. So spirituality, yeah. How many online psychics and tarot readers are there now? Jeez,
it's crazy. Like, I mean, it makes me actually not want to speak up as much, you know what I mean? Because there's become this whole thing, and it doesn't even sit just in our category of esotericism and stuff. I mean, there are whole folks that just live life through a camera, you know what I mean? And they're making millions of dollars in the last year and a half because everyone's been stuck at home. So it's kind of interesting to see all these new people popping up. And
see, if you and I lived together during pandemic, all we would have needed was your inflatable swimming pool, which I'm pretty sure we jumped in a little bit, and some bikinis, and you and me would have made so much money on Twitch.
Totally.
Just you and me frolicking with suds in the bikinis in the inflatable pool.
Totally. Yeah. I'm sure it would have sold. Totally.
Matt could have gotten his audience hooked into us. They would have been repulsed, but they would have, you know, shared it or something and been like,
yeah, do the calendar fucking shots.
Look at these retarded Gen Xers trying to be these legit or flat fire, whatever the word is. But yeah.
Well, it's tough. I mean, for folks like you that have an interesting channel into what we do, and others, it kind of waters down everything, right? Because it also plants seeds too, right?
Because, yeah, it's, I see it as casting a broad net. you know, because the more like breadcrumbs are thrown out there for people to go, hey, what's this little thing catching the moonlight on the ground? And they follow one to the next. And the ones that are really into it and into getting deeper with it, they will eventually follow those breadcrumbs and will bake them and eat them.
That's a great analogy. And
yeah,
I think I'd mentioned to you a while back of an occult book collector that said that basically when he gets rid of books, he doesn't just give them to friends. He randomly plants them in like little thrift stores and here and there, just because he knows that those books will ultimately end up in the hands of the true seeker, right?
That's very, very odd and wonderful.
Totally.
Yeah.
But you don't know what happens to all that stuff, right? I mean, for all I know, I die and my kids are like, what the hell is all this crap?
Well, it's a fortune is what it is. It's like, you know, yeah, it's not hard to have a couple hundred grand worth of books these days if you know how to collect, right? Or if you were collecting as long as we were. Yeah.
Well, and it's funny. I mean, when I let go of that book to Larry, I felt really good that it was going to a new home. But then I was like, I don't want to sell any more books. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like an all or nothing personality in some ways.
Dude, I can't get like the David Highsmith books I want that you showed me at your place. And then I now realize I'm like, oh, damn, they were available when I was down. One person even wanted to just get me one because I didn't know his work. And I was like, no, that's okay. Regret, you know? And a lot of them you can't get except secondhand for $300-$400.
They pop up from time to time. I mean,
sell them. He like once they run out, like he's got two new books coming out on the 21st for Midsummer, the Philosophical Mercury, I think, and the new translation of the Fountain of Bright Gates of Light. I can't remember. Shit. Sorry.
I mean, they pop up. I mean, unfortunately, what this has also brought on is a bunch of actual just book collectors. And a lot of those
do they suck? Is it like fuck the hardcore just collectors who are taking the books off the shelves for the practice? Well,
for example, I mean, it's nothing new, but like in Dark Grimoires, when I say dark, I say that with parentheses, right? But when you talk about these like Librephalax or Citra Atra or some of these books, they go for insane amounts of money. And granted, there's some content in those books, but people are buying them, and I see the same people like beg for people to sell them to them, and like a month later selling them for like $100 more. And what it's doing is it's keeping the stuff out of reach of folks that, you know, that are truly interested into it.
Well, I think another thing people do is they'll buy up all the existing copies of one out of print book, like for that are cheap and common. They'll buy them all up. And then they'll put them all up at like $120 when it's a $20 book.
It's very common. But I mean, if you're actually on the search for a title, you'd be really surprised. I've done hunts for books where, you know, everyone's trying to sell it for way above sticker. And you can actually get it from the publisher for regular price.
Dude, I can't wait to show you this thing that I can't even talk about right here. I'll show it to you next time. You just got to like get real close and bend over.
Well, and you have to ask yourself, I mean, people are lusting after like $800, you know, leather handbound book, you know, and then they sell it 2 months later and you're like, well, what is this book doing for you? And I think that that's what the pandemic did for me as a whole was like, if you're going to invest time in this, it's got to do something for you. It can't be a black hole of your time. It can't be just a quiet the mind rest or numb the mind, should I say. It should actually be doing something for you. And that really made me take kind of a step back a lot and really get right back into daily practice because there's too many books. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, like,
oh yeah, you don't need it, man.
You don't need it at all.
Yeah. You don't need that shit. Like, I had all these like 80-year-old copies of like all in hardcover, The Secret Doctrine, all these Blavatsky things, and all these other great, so-called great texts. But I have no desire to ever buy them or be near them ever again. You know, it would have been great to still have them to sell, but or just to have them, I guess. But, you know, yeah, especially as we get older, it's like, let's get the books that we really could get some use out of. I was just looking into Nick Farrell's Shem Grimoire, and the reviews are, of course, challenging to read because many people aren't too nice. And some of them are also just dead wrong. One of them said his language was bad and then gave an example that was actually a correct example. It was just British English. It's like, okay, so you don't know English very well, but you can't, is there typos and problems? Yeah, but that's not what's relevant. And to the point we're discussing, what's relevant is what is the information in that book? And I found out what that information was. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm not going to get that literally anywhere else. And as a huge practitioner of the Shem, I absolutely want to know what he recommends. So therefore, that's an essential book. Doesn't matter how I get the information. I just need to get it because I definitely want to try that stuff out as someone who's, that's one of my main things.
Totally. And when you talk about a guy like Nick Farrell, who has amazing works, along with another folk out there, Mark Stavish, these guys are very real about their work. I mean, they're not writing this to make you happy. They're not writing about, they're literally trying to show you practice. A lot of ways in the Emerald Tablet did, right? You know, from teacher to student and the way the stuff is supposed to be learned. And I think that those are the most amazing books, but they're not the most popular books. I mean, a lot of people just want to, look at these introductions. And I mean, you can read half a book now of 200 pages and like, only to find like 2 pages of praxis. And you're like, I mean, if you bought this book to actually do work, this was a ridiculous purchase, you know? And people like Nick, like the other one he did, Helios, which is the Greek path to the Holy Guardian Angel.
I'm absolutely going to read it.
It's a beautiful book. And if anyone actually practices it from start to finish, they would be very happy. But I think the way that it, you know, how real that book is that some people just come off rubbed off. They're not going to do the work. They kind of want to just read something that kind of keeps them in the fantasy world.
Yeah. Well, it is fun to imagine.
Oh, fantasy
about
great.
Ourselves.
Yeah.
And there is this borderland between the fictional and the really fantastical. And, yeah, there's something to be said of it, of course. I mean, inspiration is important, like so important, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's the point, right? The quintessence, right?
Go ahead. Pardon me, dude.
Go ahead, man. Do your thing.
I'm just... I found some Pineapple Express.
Just found.
I found it, at a store. On Robson Street, on the high street of Vancouver, they had a cartridge of Pineapple Express, and it's been fueling me all day.
Perfect.
But what were we saying?
Oh, we were just bullshitting about different authors and Nick Farrell's where we left off there. Stavish, again, is
Farrell's,
also one of my favorites. Go ahead.
Farrell's Helios Unbound. It's a pagan Abramelin, for those who don't know.
Yep.
So if you want to do, right, is it adaptable to different pantheons?
I suppose so, but I don't know how that would help. I think the focus...
He must do it with Greek, right?
He does it with Greek, of course. I mean, Helios.
Yeah, because he actually substituted in Greek gods I think it might have been the Cherubim in the Theurgicus initiation in his order.
Gotcha.
In 2 equals 9. I'm not sure. I think it's a rumor or something someone said. I don't know. I don't pay as much attention as I should. I'm too busy, man. Dude, I'm translating now. I'm translating. Like, I have translation project deadlines and shit.
That's
for,
great.
Like, real publishers. It's like getting on the scene, B-Hatch.
No, that's great to hear, man.
Really great to hear. Yeah. I really want things to open up still, like, my seminary's library will open up and I can go back there and talk to some profs and, you know, run a few Hebrew issues by my old Hebrew professor there and stuff. Use the library, man. You got to compare that shit. You got to, like, cross-reference keywords with their appearances in all the rabbinic literature and stuff. It's going to be fun. It's going to be fun.
I think that's great, man. I'm super excited about that. I mean, us too, back in California too. I mean, the Masonic Lodge hasn't opens up, I believe, in August. I think it's when we finally start to attend again. Even though we're clear, you know, June 15th apparently was the clear day. So I'm looking forward to that. And then, you know, just looking forward to getting together with more folks.
Really hot.
Yes, go ahead, buddy.
We're doing a Jason Newcomb's Grimoire course right now.
Oh, awesome.
So yeah, you're part of that? I'm going through it with some of my people. Actually, we just had another person jump aboard. So we haven't ever gotten to do it as we planned. So we're going to do like a Zoom meeting in like a week and talk about and have a symposium sort of thing with ourselves on what we've gone through that week. He puts a lot of content actually in his stuff. And there's a lot of really interesting points that he brings up that are so crucial to magicians developing all the different array of attributes and skills that we really need to have. And he focuses on a lot of the different ones. Like, you know, many people, I mean, if you've read any of that, I read John King's Imperial Arts, and he thinks visualization is a waste of time. And so there's a lot of these authors, maybe they're grimoire puritist, or maybe they're just dogmatic, or maybe they're just doing their own thing, who knows? But there's a lot of them that don't emphasize like bringing in essential oils and using those with maybe experimenting with some binaural beats, some like astral meditation or initiation visualizations, and attuning to different sigils, smells, stuff like that. But to me, I love that sort of low magic-y stuff, because that's actually sort of the heart of high magic. And that's how I've always seen it. Maybe it's the Scott Cunningham in me, but like, that's my jam. I like the full spectrum holistic approach to magic. And that's what is really there, as well as like handouts that you have to read. That's like, oh Jesus, you're making us read some serious literature here. So if you really do it, I do believe you'll get a ton out of it. I'm sure not everyone really does the lessons or takes them seriously, but it's pretty impressive.
It's funny you brought up John King, because I have a few of his books, and he seems to be one that's left out a lot. In discussion about Solomonic magic. And I hear there was something maybe later in his career where he was luring folks with some money scheme or something, if I remember correctly.
Oh, I didn't hear anything about that. I don't actually know anything about him. I just know what I read in Imperial Arts and what I heard on Glitch Bottle. And he seems like a fine guy, but he definitely, I mean, you sort of just got to read it.
Yeah. No, I listened to the podcast too. And actually I'm a big fan of his work. Again, it's just interesting. He doesn't come up a lot in regular discussion.
In Imperial Arts, he claims to have killed his mom by working with goetic demons, as far as I can tell.
Interesting.
As well as two other people in an earthquake that he intentionally caused. So, and one thing that struck me when he, in his notes, is like, he wasn't in his requests of these, or his, in his bindings of these spirits. Like, he said, make me a 6.5 greater earthquake in this area. And then one happened and two people died. And he, in any of his phrasing, he never adds, don't let someone get hurt. And like the when his mom died, he says it was because he was hired by this jewelry mentor of his, whose shop he wanted to take over, to expedite his mother's death. So he was hired to use goetic demons to expedite this other guy's mom's death. And instead, his own mom died. I believe that is what he says, but y'all can check it out. He definitely deserves for people to buy his book, which is the only way to read this stuff, off Lulu or whatever. And they're not expensive, but well, some of them are. But either way, his work deserves to be taken seriously, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, no, I love his work. Yeah.
Yeah, it's and one of my buddies was telling me about like the visionary drawing he does shows that there's a lot of visualization involved in his imagining of things. Otherwise, he wouldn't do these beautiful pages of his own grimoire.
Interesting.
Complicated man, I'd say. I mean, a lot of these guys are going to definitely go down in the books. I mean, John King, Ashley Shazan, Stephen Skinner, these are people with very distinct perspectives, but who are doing the work very seriously. And that's of so much value to all of us, right?
Definitely. And it's crossing boundaries too. Like, I think the other day I saw something with Frederick Ashen who was talking about talismans that he sells. And, you know, there was a couple gals at the beach in bikinis and Fredder Ashen's talismans. And I thought, wow, things are really getting out there. You know what I mean? Like, and talk about the respect, you know, you meet a gal at the beach, you know, in a bikini and you're like, wow, is that the sixth pentagram of the sun? Is that
so people that bought his talismans were posed in bikinis, eh?
Yeah, no, he posted it too, and I think he's proud of it. I don't think that's even like be. Yeah, exactly.
Dude, whenever you've been on tour and girls put on your band merch, you take a fucking photo and post it.
Exactly. There's nothing to be disappointed about there or be ashamed of, right? I mean, that's
cool. Ashy Chassis gets the heavy metal devil horns for sure.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, no, he's super cool too. He has his seminars up in the Midwest, I believe. I know a few folks that have gone to him, and they seem to be very, very useful.
Yeah, I'd love to do some of his stuff. That was like that's big on the wish list for sure.
Definitely. No, he seems to have a really killer eye and has a bunch of resources to procure these really interesting occult curios, right? I mean, the stuff he finds is amazing. But then again, he probably knows what he's looking for, right?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine us all getting to hang out and see each other at conferences or retreats again, but it will happen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's hard to say how it will happen, you know, and when. I mean, even in the music industry, which is what I'm from day to day, is, you know, our annual trade shows are delayed. We're not sure, you know, what we're going to do. We are obviously going to attend our one yearly one, but the question has been raised, is it actually something we need to do?
Wow. Yeah.
And I personally think so. You know, I personally am a big fan of getting in contact face to face with folks, but, you know, we'll see.
Has there been any band practices or anything like that? Probably not, I guess.
We finally got back into it. In fact, my heavy metal band, Trial by Combat, is back at it. In fact, we didn't get to release our album officially because it was set to release, I believe, a month into the pandemic. So we held on to the recording, did some music.
That videos. Was smart.
Oh my goodness. And so now we've got we just got hired for the support for some big acts that are coming at the end of the year. And then the 80s band is just getting all sorts of requests. In fact, I got 3 gigs today.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it's going
Can you
wild.
Tell us some of the bands?
This particular band is called Choppin' Broccoli. And I never ever thought I'd end up in an 80s cover band, but I have to say it's been a shit ton of fun. And it pays
I had to
very
like play
well.
Backup guitar on like Pat Benatar for a while. It was a trip.
You know, when the money is great because people know what they want. You know, they hear the tunes that they grew up with, and you know, we put on a show, we give them a good time, and you know, it is what it is.
That's right, motherfucker. Oh, there's also I gotta tell you after. I'll tell you after. It's summertime and things are happening again. Music, teaching, film, things are happening again, bro.
Everything's waking up. Yeah, everything's waking up big time.
I mean, yeah, it's I'm hopeful, like tentatively. We'll see.
Totally.
At the very least, we can keep talking. It's crazy to think that this podcast came out of this madness or like this. Yeah, because I did a little bit of podcasting before, but not seriously. And that's weird.
It's weird. Well, it would, you know, it's the opportunity. You got to take advantage of it, right? I mean, I've never listened to as many podcasts as I have in the last year. Right. I mean, come on. I mean, it's crazy.
I'll be like, oh, it's 3.5 hours, no big deal. That's just a half my morning.
No, totally.
dude, anything good you've seen recently? Pardon my.
You know,
it's just a DMT overdose.
Just typical day in the neighborhood.
Dude, a mushroom dispensary just opened up next door, and I was like, "What the fuck? This is crazy!" And then they were like, "Oh, well, there's already one down on the main street at Davey and Granville," and I was like, and there's one opening up down at Denmining. So at the beginning, end, and middle of like one of the main streets of the city, there's now three mushroom dispensaries.
Yeah, that's a big thing here in California. Berkeley's just passed a thing where I think they legalized mushrooms, and they're working on LSD currently. It's a trip. It's really a trip. I mean, like, I'm both happy that things are getting liberated, but I'm also kind of worried at the same time because everyone's like their own doctor in California. Like, everyone's their own therapist. Everyone's their own, you know, health nutritionist. And so everybody self-diagnosed like everything. And so the last thing we need is just like this unlimited tap of, you know, mushrooms, you know.
California, here we come.
Yeah. Yeah,
baby. You guys are nuts out there, aren't you? Well, just a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, things are nuts. I mean, yeah, what we tolerate is crazy. In fact, our governor just promoted the fact that he's in his next campaign, because right, he's going through re-election and like a bunch of people want to get rid of him. He just promoted that he would allow drive-through alcohol to continue.
Sure. Well, anything to try and beat Caitlin, right?
Isn't it crazy? I mean, like, I remember Caitlin's
got my vote.
I mean, driving with an open container in California was like an epic no-no ever since I was growing up,
but the driver can't be drinking it.
They can, but it's an open container. There's just like a little sticker or something that, like, you know, don't break the
seal. That makes sense. In Europe, like in Germany, you can drink if you're not driving. Like, so, like, first time we were driving the Autobahn going from convention to convention for the board game thing, we were at a gas station, and at the checkout of the gas station, bottles of Jaeger. So we all grabbed one each, got in the car, told the old guy to drive on the Autobahn. He was terrified, and we all just got hammered in the other seats. And it was terrifying because, like, you're going like 200 clicks. And you're still the slowest car in the slowest lane. And these cars are just blasting past you. No speed limit.
What a trip, man. I mean, and I talked to some friends here locally that were, you know, sitting in their house for a year, you know, and when the legalization of the mushrooms came out, they were all like, you know, grabbing bags of mushrooms and tripping at home by themselves. It was trippy, I mean, man.
We live in places where it's never really been hard to get stuff like that, of course.
Well, the
way it's happening now is speaks well of how things will develop for other places.
I think that we touched on this a little bit in a conversation. I don't think we did a recording or anything, but I was reading a Facebook post by a friend, and they were talking about, you know, teacher to student transmission, right? And it came up that drug use is probably one of the oldest teacher to student transmissions.
Oh, interesting.
And nowadays kids can go on YouTube and like figure out how to do things, but like back when we were growing up, you had to know somebody to know how to prepare something or deal with something. And if you think about it, it's actually one of the oldest surviving traditions, and it's been replaced by, you know, people, you know, vaping on YouTube and whatever else, right? Free base and weed.
Well, I mean, we have the pop shamanism now, but yeah, it's an old tradition, you're right.
All those things were like how much to eat, you know, like how to prepare it. And usually, and I know you remember this is kind of funny, like we talk a lot about ayahuasca teas and DMT, and these drugs were designed for a teacher to sit with a student, like a shaman, right, and prepare them for the trip, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's kind of different now, right? I mean, people just get these things and they try them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a total trip. I mean, it's funny that I say that, but when that point was raised, my brain just went, oh my God, that is one of the oldest surviving situations.
Yeah. I mean,
like, if you wouldn't, there are certain drugs that you wouldn't even know how to do unless someone had taught you how to do it.
Yeah, you just wouldn't know.
You just wouldn't know. And you look at the current situation with like fentanyl and opiates, it's no wonder that people are dying left and right.
There's no transmission of knowledge.
There's no transmission of knowledge because they're replacing it.
It's just like Yeah. Oh my god.
Oh. It's a total trip.
Yeah. Hey, do you want to talk about the vibratory technique stuff you figured out?
Sure.
Yeah.
So
you and me had some pretty powerful magical experience together at your place in your temple.
Tahuti, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I showed you how a Tahutian does Tahuti or how we did it. And it's classic, of course. It just was powerful. But yeah, you've been pushing it hopefully ever since.
Yeah, I've been pushing it ever since, and you know, doing you know my daily exercises and working with vowels, and of course, you know, a music guy like yourself. So I've correlated things like you know color, of course, you know, with notes, just like the original Fare Ra Temple did, and then was pushed much further with people like Paul Foster Case.
Oh, and the best book for that is especially if you can read notation. Is Jocelyn Godwin's The Power of Vowels or whatever.
I will check that out.
Yeah.
I'm sure that
Jocelyn Godwin did the Splendor Solus, right? I literally got to like.
And now a word from our sponsors. Well, we cannot control whether any ads get put in the spots allocated. We thank you for listening to those that do, since they help keep this project alive. You can also get ad-free content and bonus content and videos and a private webpage by subscribing exclusively to magicwithoutfears.com for only a couple dollars a week or $6 a month or $50 for the year. It helps a lot. Plus you get emails about other exclusive things. Thank you very much.
I was randomly at a lunch with him at the University of Michigan in 2004. Jocelyn Godwin, like I think it was Alison Kuder, Nicholas Goodrich Clark, and a couple others, like the main people at the ASE conference. I didn't know what was going on, right? I was just some dumbass 24-year-old who was almost in the wrong place at the wrong time, but I traveled a long ways to be there. But fuck, man, Jocelyn Godwin's a machine, man. When you look at his scholarship, and I tried to read his book on the power of vowels or the vowels and stuff, but my musical, I'm not that good at reading them. Treble clef, you know, like I can do it slowly, which is fine, you know, but when I pick up a violin, I can slowly walk through the notes, no problem. But he gets into the theory, but it's all from this very magical perspective, like, and I think it's overlooked. So I'd be very fascinated by someone with your knowledge level in that area to see what your opinion is on that.
I would love to check it out in looking at those different.
It's a tiny
works.
Paperback.
So okay.
It costs nothing.
I'll check it out. I mean, in, you know, working with you in the little time that we worked together, I quickly realized the importance of vibrating the entire body, right? You know, or in or volume, you know,
yeah.
When doing your vowel work.
And, well, you even said Chick pointed that out once half his audience left. Wasn't that you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people don't realize how much you need to actually want it. I mean, are you just going through the exercises? Are we doing, like, for example, that's a good analogy with exercise, right? Like you can do sets of 10 push-ups over and over again, but everyone knows that those last two push-ups that burn the hell out of you.
I got better, bro. This is better. Voice exercises. When you're doing like Seth Riggs style, which is like he's the guru of voice exercises, like the man, undeniably.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're doing these trills like, but you're bending forward at the same time, and you're shooting them up as quickly as you can with this trill sound without your lips opening and without your cheeks expanding as high as it goes, like to the point where it's way out of key. But it doesn't matter. You're hitting it over and over, like until it hits over and over, higher and higher and higher, and then you just sing the thing normally, and all of a sudden the muscles in your throat like know better what to do, and it's fucking insane. So it's like you have to hit that max volume for you to actually expand your vocal range and to expand your control of the notes. So if you think of that in terms of vibratory technique, golden vibratory technique, yeah, you have to push it to the max volume and to the max expression for it to actually improve and get more strong, so that it's actually stronger even at lower vibrational emphases, just because it is very, very unique to the GD, but I mean other people are doing it, and I think they should.
Well, and I think it works in any kind of voweling practice, you know, whether you're doing Rosicrucian, you know, Ra, Ma, Om, all these things. I think that the thing that my take home is that when you get loud enough and vibrate enough, it actually quiets down the brain even more. Because you're not thinking about what you're doing anymore. You're just experiencing what you're doing. And so from that.
Exactly. And so you've been pushing that. You've been experimenting with that after you heard me vibrate.
Exactly. And so from there, I started working with the fourfold breath, excuse me. And I started incorporating this idea. I thought, well, wait a sec. What if I breathe in on the vowels and out with the same vowels? And what I found that you do naturally is I can't say, you know, everybody, because I do play music and I'm kind of musically inclined, right? But you naturally use the lower octave on the exhale and the higher octave on the inhale. And what's cool about this, I think, is that if you actually practice it, you're going to learn to circular breathe, right? Like the opera singers. I remember back in the day, we used to take a straw and a glass and you would try to drink the water, but breathe in at the same time. And if you can actually complete that, you'll do a full circular breathe. And just like opera singers practice this to be able to hold notes for 2 minutes or 3 minutes, I think it even breathes more true to what we're talking about and vibrating. So I started experimenting with that. And I found that it became like a battery, you know. It's one thing to breathe in and vowel out and breathe in and vowel out. But when you're breathing in and intoning on the exhale, it's like steroids for the sphere. And so, as you know, like I started working on this and I thought I found something that was groundbreaking and it was working for me. So I share it with you.
You shared it with me. And I was like, I was very convinced that you had read a certain 5=6 document that is out there on the internet floating around from our order, the order I was trained in, which trained some of the guys in your order, specifically David Hogan, who initiated you, was a student. Yeah, he, your mentor, who was a student of mine 20 years ago when he was in Portal and I was the head of Tahuti at the Power Week. So he was at lectures of mine, which is cool. I remember the guy, and he was a really cool dude, which is why we have rad text exchange talking with Star Trek. But yeah, he was like, we both recognized it as this 5-6 document on the advanced vibratory technique of the middle pillar. So you came into it all on your own.
Yeah, that was interesting. And I think that that's important, because whenever you do this type of work, right, you look for from a scientific perspective too, like you can't go all hands in just metaphysical, but when we see that people, like for example, the zodiacal signs in the faces of them, whether you look at Arabic astrology or Chinese astrology or anyone, you see the same dictations of them, right? Yeah. And so the fact that I stumbled upon this, of course, thinking it was my own, and only defined by my mentors like you and David, that it's actually a part of a later teaching, to me is more of the you know, more than coincidence, which is what you start off, I think, a lot in the occult. You get those deja vus and coincidences, and then you finally stumble upon breadcrumbs.
What I like is that some things in the system just start to become obvious if you work the preliminaries enough. And that's why I still am and focused on teaching the preliminaries and the basics, because people underestimate where you can get to with it and what it reveals about advanced techniques. Like some of the most very advanced techniques I've ever learned are absolutely just extensions of the earliest, most basic things you would learn. And, after that, I guess it's just a matter of expansion of your mind and consciousness and personal power that allows you to access them more. Like you with the, you know, advancing the vibratory technique, which is just sort of obvious. The document has a visualization that goes with it as well. And then that technique again is expanded on and used for the techniques for the great voice. And that is different in different traditions. And a real question, which you asked very intelligently to one of the few people that could answer it, is whether or not this tradition teaching goes back to the original Golden Dawn, which you found out the answer was
no.
No, of course
not. That was what's so interesting is that, you know, I came up upon this and was thinking about writing a whole exercise around it. And then I'm quickly told by you and David that this already exists. And then
yeah, we don't know who wrote it, really. We don't
nobody knows. In fact,
nobody knows.
In fact, Tony Fuller spoke, he filled in the pieces. Oh. He said that while this is not a part of the original practice, it's possible that could have happened in different orders, which apparently it did, right? From talking to you and David.
Yeah.
But his comment at the end was so cool because he said, I have no doubt that this probably works and I admire you, you know, to innovate, you know, and I think that that's really important for folks, of course, once they grow their legs in the occult, to change and innovate, you know, don't water down, but not be afraid to, you know what I mean, elaborate
yeah,
and change yeah. and grow the order's teachings.
And that's where I love and hate the Golden Dawn tradition, because I love it because so many people within it are innovating and expanding, but within the tradition, but also like feel that some of the more dogmatic elements are there. It's a mixture of preserving and limiting what is.
It's tough. And I think that the teacher student thing has worked for a long time, but there's something funny about people in general is they want to get together with others to study the same thing, even if it's something as secret as the occult, right? And yeah. really quickly, whether it's, you know, Masonry or, you know, Golden Dawn or Martinism, when you get a group of people together, there's always problems. You know, there's always things you have to deal with because now you're not only dealing with an esoteric current, you're dealing with this new community. And I admire all those hierophants that put up with everything and deal with all the bureaucratic parts of what none of this was ever supposed to be. But I do also, you know, I think it's amazing that they continue to carry the torch of these traditions. And even if in some cases they haven't, you know, carried it on in the way that it was planned.
Yeah.
I mean, there's probably so many other fragmented currents, you know, and I know we talked a while ago, I'm going on a tangent here, but with the whole Tool thing and Dana Carey, you know, all being like GD folks. And in fact, I've confirmed that from a few other sources.
Some say we'll see Armageddon soon. I certainly hope we will.
Totally.
Yeah, I mean, baby.
They were initiated for sure.
I miss gigging and karaoke. Yeah. I sure could use a vacation from this.
It's funny how there's this mixture of very arty and musical and academic folks in the occult. It's either one or the other, or like in the middle a lot, you know?
Yeah. Well,
it's nothing new. I mean, I played Dungeons and Dragons when I was a kid. You know, it takes a certain type to catch the cold, right, so to speak, you know, and be kind of forced into this. And I think that's something that's really not talked about a lot in occultism is that once you finally jump off the cliff as a fool, or walk off the cliff, or walk the desert, or all those other terms that people use, there's no going back.
Well, here's the other thing, is magic is very helpful when you are lacking the power to do other things.
Well, that's the whole idea right? of it. Like the story of Inanna, so, right? You know, you have to lose everything.
We're entering into this like totalitarian lockdown surveillance state, or we're there already, right? And we can't do that much about it necessarily. But what all those like dystopian sci-fi novels in 1984 didn't take into account, hear me out, is that magic is real.
No, in fact, it was used to do so, right?
Those stories never took us into account. So what are we going to do to make some shit happen.
I mean, this is an interesting subject, right?
Because maybe it's all on us. Maybe that's our divine,
you know what,
calling. And, that's the and same... we all every single flaming rose and cross in every heart has to wake up and fucking get their shit in order and get to action all across the world.
And that's the toughest part. I mean, like,
and all the witches and sorcerers rise up. We're like, no, new revolution. And then the elves and dwarves come back and we're back in Shadowrun.
I love it. And it's very, you know,
you get what I'm saying.
Awesome. But you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like when Trump was like getting into presidency, you'd have these like tens of thousands of hashtag witches that are doing these masses to make sure he doesn't become president. And it's like, he became president. You're like, and I'm not a fan or anything like that, but it's like, you know, we really have to realize what we're using the practice for. And that goes back to what I told you earlier, is this is all great information to know. Spiritual experience is awesome, but if it's not helping you or doing anything applicable, then it's really just a time suck, you know? And I think that's a realization that many people maybe don't want to hear. It's like science, right? I mean, if you're doing an experiment and you're doing it over and over again and it's not giving you results, you could buy every flask and tube and book in the world, but it's not going to help the situation. And I think there's a fine line of escapism and practical magic in our community. They're there. There are folks that actually do this and do well with it. But like every industry, 90% of it is hobbyists. You know, look at the music industry. You know, two out of 10 people own a guitar, maybe even 5 or 6, right? But not many of them play it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's why meeting you was so awesome at the fucking hotel at Pantheacon, man. We were fucking, did we play? Oh my God, did we play?
Totally.
Just
totally.
Like fucking, I can't believe our instruments survived that. It was just 2 acoustics in a hotel room. And you had a dobro, didn't you?
Yeah, I brought a dobro, man. And that's what's funny about dobro. Music, man. Music is a language, man. And it's better than words. And, you know, like I remember, you know, Suzuki. Well, you've probably had the same experience. I mean, you're a much more world traveler than I, but like, when I meet someone that cannot even understand me and I can't understand them, but they have a guitar and I have a guitar, or me on drums, they guitar, it's amazing. We talk.
Oh yeah.
You know, and that's so beautiful, right? It like surpasses language, you know, dude. Which even Hebrew is mystical. It is. It's just a transmission, right? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. The Hebrew guitar.
Well, it's an attempt, you know, it's an attempt, and hieroglyphics do a great job at that as well, but you could never explain the feeling. Like, we don't even, like, here's a funny example I think of a lot. Like, we have Beethoven's old musical, you know, symphonies, we have Mozart, but there's not a single recording of them.
Yeah, that's crazy, isn't it?
Like, for all we know, no one pulled it off, and someone else pulled it off.
Strange to think about
a lot, you know, and I think that we tend to glorify everything for good, because, you know, immortality is that, right? You know, making, like you mentioned earlier about Frater Ashenazan and Nick Farrell, and you get your Aaron Leach, these folks are definitely gonna, you know, be in the books, you know, as folks that really gave teachings to the masses and or integral
figures. Did I say Aaron Leach?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
What's that about?
Nothing. Yeah. No, I feel the way about him, the way I feel about John Michael Greer. Very, very grateful, but sometimes confused.
And are we all right? I mean, like,
yeah, which is fine.
It's like we all have areas of study, and I think this reminds me of the paradigm of science, right? You've got all these scientists that are very specialized in very specific fields, so none of them really completely understand each other's field. And I think it's quite common that you see that out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's very few macro folks that see everything as a whole, and nobody understands the whole picture as a whole, right? I mean, we specialize in our little
silos.
We look
through a glass darkly.
Exactly. And we hope, and that's why we all connect, and that's why we all converse and you know, review and read different books, is because we hope, again, that there's that understanding that everyone's little pieces will come together and create a whole, which is what science is supposed to do, right? As magic.
Oh,
right? You know?
Dude, you know what's amazing is that's where I've been getting my sort of mystical fix, because the ritual work we're doing is great. I'm loving doing this Celtic stuff and then some really hardcore Enochian Heptarchia stuff that's just building up in lovely ways, and it's quite profound. But for the spiritual fix, I've been really enjoying the David Himesmith stuff. Like, I've done a few of his lectures, like listen, you know, done the videos and done the contemplations and a lot of, you know, the reading and work, and those symbols are very very powerful. Like the first key is overwhelming. Can you give me a montage
for a minute? I gotta run for just like 1 minute. Keep going.
A montage. Oh yeah. This is a montage, we're having a little montage. But no, so David Himesmith, of course, is a non-emanationist modern Kabbalist, and he's got some new books coming out, and you can check him out at davidhimesmith.com. And his 32 Keys book and cards and course is very phenomenal. And he's bringing back a system of Kabbalah that has been overlooked, probably for the most part, but is related to the Abulafian system. And is in his approach, which comes from an oral tradition, which he was asked to finally share out of his home in New York. And here he's presenting it to us as a contemplative system of mystical development. And it's quite phenomenal and very related to the practices of the Merkava and the Hechelot, which are the two primary methods of practical Kabbalah, for lack of a better word, for definitive spiritual practices that involve taking down into the palaces of God or riding the chariot up to God. And those are both great practices. Look at R.A. Kaplan is my main influence, and his book Meditation and Kabbalah is again my main influence for Abulafian practice. That it's great to see something else hit the arena and expand things. That's what David Himesmith's done. I just explained how he's really expanded the field of practice for practical Kabbalah into this old school of practice that is non-emanationist and very powerful, very powerful.
Yeah, no, and it's amazing. I mean, not many folks get to live the life of such a genius as David Himesmith, because he lives in Hermitage. I mean,
I definitely want to go there at some point. I mean, just like is it Greg Kaminsky from A Cult of Personality was there when I was talking to him on the podcast that I did with him. I think Greg was like actually there at that time or something like that, or was about to be there. So a lot of people are going there and studying with him and contemplating with him, I guess. I'm still, you know, it's sort of back burner, but at the same time, it's fueling a lot of my internal connectivity.
Yeah, no, he's always interesting to listen. I could listen to him for hours. Sometimes I'm with him, sometimes I'm learning, sometimes I'm wowing. But he's definitely a genuine soul as far as the path goes. And when you talk to him, as you have, and listen to him, it's obvious, you know, that he has something to bring. In his last interview, I think it was with Eric Simpkins, he was talking a lot about how the channeling happens. In fact, I think at one point he had...
I'm not there yet. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, apparently he was painting paintings over and over again because his mentor had told him, paint everything you know. And he literally was in one room and painted for like 2 weeks straight and had to paint everything he ever knew. In him telling that story, it was quite obvious how the trajectory started in his path with his artwork. Because this was before I think he was very well known. And I don't want to call it artwork because that's not what he likes to call it. These are images that come to him from the divine, not to be confused with artwork, as he says. And so when he painted all these things, he put them all around.
Yeah, you shouldn't put them on your walls, Jesse.
Yeah, no, that I learned that. I learned that the hard way.
Do you want to tell me what happened?
Oh my god!
Just because it's fucking funny.
He'll probably hear it and just be so angry. But you know,
he already was angry, so he's let it go.
He's let it go.
Enlightened soul. Yeah. He's like, look at this fucking poor pin. So tell people what you did.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I love you,
Johnny, on the spot. So yeah, of course, you know, I love his work. I love his books, and I found some awesome images that he had shared. And rather than just being like a pirate, like, because my whole generation is like, take it, right? Like LimeWire, Napster, all that shit, right? Rather than being a complete jerk, I reached out to him and I said, look, I love this. I'd love to print this, put it on a canvas. And to my surprise, he answered me back quite quickly and said, yeah, dude, in fact, here's the high-res photos. And here I'm like, oh my god, dude, you know, you ask, you shall receive, right? So he sends me the,
what a mensch.
Totally. And that's actually after I offered to buy them, but at that point in time I don't think he sold any of these prints. And so I got the artwork and I'm at work just trying to hustle and do my thing, and I see, like, you know, the whole Amazon canvas service. And so I set it up, blah, 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 buy a couple prints, get them in the mail. And when they come in the mail, what do I find? They weren't set up right. So the prints were larger than the actual frame. So part of it, the artwork, or again, not artwork.
Oh, right? And that was the heresy?
So the artwork went around the sides. And honestly, I thought it was kind of cool personally, because when you come to the side of the painting,
well, I saw still, them. Yeah.
Yeah. They're beautiful. I thought
they looked awesome. Yeah. Gorgeous.
And here I am, I get these prints, and I'm so excited to share them with Mr. David Chaim Smith. And I send him a couple photos. They said, dude, thank you so much. And what do I get back was you ruined the piece, destroy them. And I'm like thinking, I'm not going to destroy them, but okay, I will destroy them. Let me know. And he sat on it for a minute and he basically said, you don't have to destroy them, but you know, you totally made a mess of my art. And so I have these two ashamed art pieces in my collection that are which is a great selling point, right? Like, you know, these are the pieces that he didn't want, right?
but exist with permission.
Exactly.
There's bastard children.
You know, and it's the classic story of trying to do the right thing and totally get backlashed on it. But I think it's kind of comical now, because I'm sure he'd probably laugh it off these days.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's such a good sport. He's such a great guy to talk to, as my banter with him showed, I think. Yeah, and that was really wonderful, because his work is fabulous. So,
and you got him to open up in a lot of areas that I don't think that I've heard other podcast.
Well, I'm just crazy, you know. But I'll talk to him again soon. So yeah, more to come. We've also got like Cliff from Enoki and Today happening this weekend, and Frater D from, you know, that Light In Extension.
Yes, there's a part two. There's a part two.
Author, yeah, part, yeah. So yeah, the author Frater D from the MacGyver Golden Dawn Temple article is back on my podcast. Our first one was when I was up in quarantine up in the mountains, so I had bad internet, he had bad internet, and together it was a recording shit show that really shouldn't have been released, but I wanted some of that information out there for those who could suffer through the glitchy recording. So we're doing a redux, not round two, we're doing full redux, and we're going to cover a lot of that stuff again, but even add in more. We got a full outline and we're going to go hardcore into it with this Irish Golden Dawn Adept.
I will definitely check that out.
Yeah, that'll be fun. That's I think happening Thursday or something like that, early for me because of Ireland time. He's also got very interesting experience in the Camphill arena, which is the Rudolf Steiner's organization that works with differently abled people and, you know, special people. They had one attached to my Waller school growing up, and, you know, we still made fun of them, unfortunately, but we also had were trained in a lot of empathy for them, which I don't think would have happened at all at a public school. So that was nice. We're like,
that's a generational thing. I think yeah. that, like, we were raised to succeed, like, on every level from the 50s, right?
Well, they taught us, like, spiritual philosophy around some of the ideas around why mm-hmm. kids would be born that way. That Steiner, I think, believed that some of those kids were born like that to teach us compassion or something like that,
and that's which can amazing. Still
be twisted to sound bad.
No, but that's actually amazing. So considering the notion at the time was not to be so compassionate, and the fact that the aim of the utopian society would still have compassion for those that didn't fit the model of the utopian mission, I think is a very, I'll get Martinist on you. It's kind of a
get Martinist on me.
Yeah, it's the way of the heart, right? I mean, he obviously he followed the way of the heart. And I think that that's really what's missing a lot from a lot of orders.
Amen, brother. Hey, so speaking of Martinism, any news in the realm of Martinism?
There's always new news. Thank you for the segue, Frater. Yeah, Paul Reyna and his OMS organization is amazing. And I say that from an outside view because I'm not a member of his organization. But the amount of print material he's releasing to the public, he does still have some stuff that he keeps to his OMS members for obvious reasons. He's on fire right now. And in fact, I don't give him all the credit on the recent translation because it was also done through one of his friends. Actually, his friend did the translation, but he's been publishing it. And the newest title is called The Lessons of Lyons, Instructions for the Elus Koans. It was interesting about this title is there has been recently a lot of book publications claiming to have published most of the Elus Koans material. More recently would be the Green Book from Hellfire Publishing. And anyone who knows anything about Hellfire Publishing knows that they're not the most reliable. Very few.
Yeah, people, dude. Actually. Dude, you showed me so many sick books you got from them that other people never got shipped to them. And weren't you like, didn't you just be like, dude, you're sending me this book? What the fuck?
I don't know, dude. I mean, I can't speak on Amon's behalf because he does do excellent work. But, you know,
but a lot of people spend hundreds of dollars and never get their books, right?
But I approached him differently than I would in my sales career, where I'd be on someone's ass all the time. I basically pumped his ego up and was like, yeah, dude, these are beautiful books. Get it to me when you can get it to me. And honestly, I think I own maybe 15 titles from him and maybe didn't get one title, which was The Magus. And when I purchased the Green Book from Martinism from him, from Elus Koans, it actually came and I had a bunch of friends that were burned and I just felt so awkwardly odd and happy in the same way. Like, damn, he's obviously ships me all the books, but damn, he's burning everybody.
I mean, it's sort of like the what the fuck do you expect? It's the Hellfire Club.
Well, what's funny about that, and he probably he'd probably hate me saying this, but like after burning a lot of people out of books, he sent out a mass invitation to the Hellfire Club. I have it with me here somewhere, which at first I was like, damn, Amon again. But then I looked at it, and apparently everybody who ever attempted to order a book got this invitation. And it's like a $250, you know, welcome into the thing, get a book. get this and that. And I thought, if he sent like 10,000 people this expensive mailer,
it's not good, right? That is, yeah.
You know what I mean? To burn a lot of people with books and then send out a mass mailer, probably at least 10K, was really interesting. And no disrespect to him.
It's the Hellfire
Club. Do what's right. It's the Hellfire fucking
club. Aren't they supposed to be wankers? That's the whole point, right? Like,
yes, that's not far from the truth. Yeah, it's not far from the truth. They have their Abbey of Philema. But, you know, going back to Martinism, Paul Reina's book is why I brought up the Green Book, actually, to be honest, was because he did an honest review of it, because everyone was saying, and again, no disrespect to the gentleman that wrote it, and I do love that book a lot, but Paul Reina said, this is great, but it's missing all sorts of integral parts of the text. And he did a full review showing exactly what was missing from the text. Wow. And I think it fueled his fire to the point where he finally released a few titles that filled in all of the blanks in between.
Wow.
Which I think originally was only it was only available to his, you know, OMS group.
Give the rundown for someone who doesn't know what Martinism is, just briefly, because we have talked about it a bunch and it's
totally about. I'll do the best I can with like the elevator pitch, right?
The elevator pitch.
so basically there was a Gnostic stream of current of thought that had been sitting in the ages for a long time, but it was actually brought back up by Pasquale was his name. And Pasquale was a high-level French Mason. In fact, for those that don't know, there are three main degrees in Masonry, and then there were some higher degrees that eventually would become the Scottish Rite. In fact, some of the Scottish Rite degrees were written by Pasquale. Pasquale wanted to create his own, you know, order to basically get back into the union with the divine. It was heavily ceremonial magic.
What years were these when Pascal lived?
I don't have the dates on the top of my head. Here we go. Pasquale, don't have them.
18th century?
Little before that, because the Reconstruction rituals by Jean Baptiste Willermoes were more 1700s. Late 1700s, so a little bit earlier than that, maybe 1750s or so. And this gentleman was dead set on connecting with the divine, and more importantly with Jesus Christ. He also brought along with all the Gnostic teachings of the deluge, which for those that don't know, there are archons or forces that keep us down from realizing that we're a part of an initial spark of creation. And what's actually more important about this story is that his secretary was a man named Louis Claude de Saint Martin, and Louis Claude de Saint Martin was his secretary, very much like how Israel Lagarde took teachings from before. But Louis Claude de Saint Martin didn't feel that heavy ritual work was really the way to Christ. And what he did is he grabbed onto some old teachings from Bohem, or what we know as the Way of the Heart. And he basically, he didn't water it down, but he took away a lot of the ceremonial magic from it. But at the same time, Louis Claude de Saint Martin passed his
tradition. I think people just say Saint Martin.
Saint Martin, thank you.
Yeah, I think so.
So he was the secretary, and he passed a lot of this tradition on, and eventually ended up in the hands of Jean Baptiste Willermoes and Robert Anne Boleyn, which is another person that kept these traditions alive. And they are very well and alive today. I wouldn't say as much as they were back then, but they're very popular. It was a very grandiose thing. I mean, the Alouse Coens was like the I don't have it in front of me, but it's like the Grand Commanders, Knights of the Universe. It was like some very He-Man kind of idea. They were serious about this. But when you get deep into it, you start to see Shem Angels, and you get to see some other things that you'll see Golden Dawns and other things.
Yeah, they really want to initiate me when I go down and hang out with Jeff and meet Paul. But I'm very stoked to see, you know, Jeff and some other friends. It's been 25 years, so and they're like, yeah, we'll just initiate. I'm like, maybe. it's always interested me, and I'm such a lover of Meditations on the Tarot and Valentin Tomberg's work, and he was, you know, quite an ardent Martinist, and it's just a very interesting estuary of the secret stream, you could say.
It really is, and then again, it's another quasi-Masonic thing, you know, kind of like Golden Dawn was founded, and it's just another way that these people broke off and obviously weren't getting what they wanted from the regular Masonic lodges. And
well, people need it. People like useful structures to study things, right? And you know, having spiritual experiences within structures is helpful, and that's one of the reasons I think the Masonic ethos carries along to so many different things, like really so many things.
Definitely,
you know.
And these are all egregores that we built. I mean, they're still around, you know. As long as people keep feeding that egregore, it's going to keep being alive.
Yeah, and humans organize in certain patterns. Definitely. Because, yeah, it's helpful. So, your order's going along okay?
Orders are going along well. The Golden Dawn out of Austin, Order Golden Dawn, is resuming meetings. In fact, I plan on flying out there very soon to finish some initiation work.
Is that Zelator or Theorcus?
Zelator.
Booyah, baby.
Yeah. Then I meet with the Martinist order that I belong to, their order Martinist, with David as well. So I'm looking forward to that, seeing old friends and reconnecting. But while I'm in
multiple,
Austin,
multiple Martinist orders in Austin.
That's the weirdest part, is I figure while I'm in Austin and visiting them, I might as well go try to connect with Paul Reyna and kind of see what he's up to. He seems like he's up to a lot, and what are the people to follow?
Well, I'll give you Jeff's number. You just call him up and go for some barbecue.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely do it. Send me a fucking postcard, eh? Jesus. I have another buddy you could meet up with there too. My buddy Ryan. You should meet up with him. Definitely.
I mean, honestly, Austin just felt like an extension of California, San Francisco.
It's a place. I mean, I definitely want to go see my friends there at some point. And, yeah, that would be good. Be good. I've never seen Texas, and I think it would be good to see Texas.
Oh, you'd love it, especially Austin. It's great.
I've always loved the cowboy boots and hats. What can I say, man? I've worn cowboy boots and hats on stage like so many fucking times, even
Austin
for metal shows.
Isn't as much cowboy. Yeah.
No, it's not. I know Austin's totally fucking weird. Yeah, which is fine. I can wear whatever I want.
Yeah, exactly.
Just walk around in a Nemus.
Why not? No one would say anything
either.
What
up? Fucking like hate Ashbury.
Now, what I loved about it up there is that everyone hangs out. There's like this, I think it's called the Greenback or the Green Belt or something. It's like this, it's like this river that runs through, and everyone just like hikes and finds a spot on that river.
Beautiful.
It's just amazing because it's like the one watering hole that's there. Like where I'm from, there's all sorts of them, right, in California.
Yeah,
so it was interesting to see how they do it.
No, cool. You guys have a drought now or something?
Apparently, yeah. No, apparently the lakes are a little bit low. We got a little bit of a drought situation. I don't know, dude. It's so political because the wineries aren't getting fines or being restricted, but apparently residentials that go over a certain amount are getting like $1,000 fines.
Cthulhu for president.
Well, it was funny. I looked at the list of things and I was like, wineries aren't on this list. What the heck? They're the ones. I mean, for those that aren't from California, like Northern California, everything is grapes. Like everything is grapes.
Yeah. It's some interesting landscape.
It is. No, it's beautiful nonetheless, but it's becoming more touristy and more expensive. You know, this was kind of a hidden spot where I live here in West County, and now it's become like the desired real estate. So everything's going up.
Yes. And you built your own house.
Yes. We built our house from the ground up.
Yeah.
As painful as
it Amen.
Was. But hey, I have in-wall speakers.
Yeah. Yeah. You've quit the dungeon. People can see the 3 hours of us exploring it on my IGTVs on Instagrams. Yeah, that was fun.
Oh, it was a total blast. I was probably two sheets in the wind, but it was great. We'll have to do it again.
after you know, the wars end.
Yeah, it'll end. You know.
I don't know, man. Do you think there's going to be like, a war soon? Like you have a people might not know this, but you have a podcast and it's politics. So it's like heavy metal alt musicians and occultists talking politics. That's novel. Okay, so what's your podcast and what do you think the fuck's gonna happen with China and Taiwan?
Oh man, you know, in the last year, if anyone like tried to use any common sense, they were literally met with like, you're a racist, you're an idiot, you know. So, you know, my lead
singer and I,
well, they were. And you know, and anyone that knows me knows that I hate politics. Like, I literally hate politics because we all know they're money-fed people, right? Like, they all say the right things in the right times and often not so. But we and see we know. Through all that.
Right. Yes.
You know, and in the last year, people just literally sided on stuff. And so me and my middle, lead singer, Dashiell McKenzie, started a podcast. And we started doing a few episodes. And he has a similar, you know, take that I do on things. Obviously, we grew up with a lot of the same culture and media and that sort of thing. But we question a lot of the mainstream thinking. And it's actually really been really good to see more people speaking up, both from the scientific community and just in general, you know, as especially what you're going through up there in Canada. Ridiculous. It's beyond
draconian. I think it's just like, this is just the transition between full, like autocratic surveillance state. Like there's going to be a bit of growing pains, but that's what's happening, and there's nothing really going to stop it. I mean, like I said, I said to you before we started, like Trudeau's like jailed his opposition. It's like that's what China and Russia does. They like
that's what they try like, to do. In the who US wants too. To
run? Who's going to run against me? Okay, you're going to jail. It's like okay, who wants to run against me? No one, because like what the fuck?
And that's why I stay away from those conversations because it puts you in a corner. It's like, I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat, but I can see through all this bullshit. And if anyone who's awake in the US or even maybe Canada too, is that the CIA has been at work at this for so long. You know what I mean? And the only president we ever had in the US that actually wanted to disband the CIA was good old JFK. And you saw what happened.
Yeah, what happened to him? Why didn't he finish that?
Well,
fucking slacker.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The day before he announced, you know, what was going to happen, how he was going to disband the CIA. And the next day he died.
He committed suicide.
And we all know that the CIA runs all of the back end of the social media and everything we see and eat and drink. It's ridiculous, you know.
So we should just give up and be good little pod people.
No, we should stand up, you know, and I want to be very, very correct here that standing up does not mean being some right wing, you know, nationalist weirdo. It does mean speaking up when you see freedoms being taken away. And somebody has to do it, you know, and we're seeing more and more people coming into real, like the whole cancel culture thing seems to be dying off. I'm not sure if you've seen that, but it seems to be waning off.
I don't know. My mom's still really into it. Whenever she sees something she doesn't like, she just says cancel. Like out loud into the air in front of her, like cancel, cancel.
Cancel, cancel.
Yeah. I'm like, what the fuck? And she's like, I'm canceling it. I'm like, you're adorable.
You know, I mean, in all honesty, it might make people feel better to not see media that they don't like. But the reality is that creative people have not been creative for the last year. Because why? You know what I mean? The whole idea of art in my generation was to test boundaries.
I've written one song in the last year.
And that's common. Most of my musician friends didn't even pick up their instruments. I have a handful of folks that actually did well with it and, you know, wrote some tracks, did some collaborations, but most people didn't do anything. They literally did nothing. And what they did is they just plugged in. And I'm guilty at times too, of just scrolling and seeing what's there and what's, you know what I mean?
It's sort of lucky if you had that luxury. I mean, yeah, you know, I wouldn't wish scrambling on anybody. So if you had a chance to just sit back and maybe, like, I sort of wish I could have spent the entire COVID time, like, playing all these video games I'd never played since 1990, like, all this cool shit. Like, but I had to bust ass just to survive. But it would have been pretty cool.
Well, it was a new thing.
Played all those things. Or, like, just done something totally absurd. Or, I don't know. Who knows? But it wasn't free time. It's been, like, insanely extra hard work to survive without like normal labor.
Well, and it completely changed the paradigm. I mean, you know, I work from home now. I mean, I was in an office 40 hours a week normally.
Are you ever going back to the office?
According to my boss, probably not.
You don't need it. Save on the rent, right?
I mean, I'm not going to complain. I get to have a clean house all the time, and I get to, you know what I mean? I get to do my job from home. I don't have to spend an hour a day driving back and forth. I'm not, you know, in a rush to leave work to go pick up my kids. It's changed everything.
Yeah. That's awesome. Like, and plus your home is sick. Like, of course you can like take a break and just grab one of these fucking amazing books from your library and dive in for a bit. Like, yeah, shit, man. Definitely. Offices made no sense. Like, people work slower to just run out the clock.
Like, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. I think I found that, you know, working from home, when I finally have dialed it in, I'm probably twice as productive as a single day in an office place. But it takes discipline. It took a while to get there. I mean, it's hard.
When I was in grade school, my mom would let me take a lot of what I called learning days. And this was a thing. So once every maybe few weeks, I would take a learning day and I'd stay home from school because I wanted to read a bunch of things and learn a bunch of things that I just wasn't, you know, it was, school was so slow, you know, and that was a common thing in my life.
Oh, that's totally cool. Yeah.
It makes sense, right? Like these environments aren't really serving their purpose anymore, especially the industrial origin of our education system is so clearly outdated now. Just looking at the developments and what we've come to in understanding adult education in general, we really need to take like a whole new look at the entire system, especially with what online options provide us to augment and complement other teaching formats.
No, I mean, for example, when I went to high school, if you were an introvert and you weren't into being socially popular, the idea of getting through all your school in a year or two was actually available to you if you looked for it. You know, I knew a few cats of mine that took junior college classes, you know, freshman year or sophomore year, and they were able to graduate maybe 2 years before everyone else. And I think online schooling has that ability. I mean, for that introvert that doesn't want to talk with people but wants to learn, I mean, why keep the whole class at this level when this kid obviously needs to skyrocket to the next level and beyond? Social stuff too. I mean, it's a big deal.
Yeah, when I'm talking about the improvement of education, I'm not necessarily talking about the ability for people to get degrees faster or write tests faster or learn more faster. I'm talking about a deeper level of qualitative understanding, you know? Like, we have more options now to look for interactive ways of learning that teach us more than just what you'd get from the memorization of rote and, you know, lectures.
Yeah, no, I think that's the case too. When I think about my own education, and I'd imagine you mirror it a lot, is that it was both the school, my will, and a lot of awesome mentors along the way. And I think that's the one thing that I don't think, you know, even when I was talking about a virtual environment, I don't think that really could be replaced.
Yeah, hopefully we don't have to go fully online. That would be a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, no, I think the kids are screaming to go back and hang out with each other too. I mean, but
well, people, about, all of us, yeah.
But if you think about it, the next generation, at least my kids, 9 and, you know, even all the way to 17, they were prepared for this. You know, they were already chatting with their friends and playing video games online and content in their bedroom.
Do you think some of them enjoyed it?
I think a lot of them just thought it was kind of just a continuation of that. And in talking with a lot of parents, you know, there's so many parents that didn't do anything, you know, I mean, about screens and things like that, because they didn't, you know, they felt bad. And when these kids weren't doing anything in school, like they were staring at the screen when the classes were there. And if I didn't follow up with my kids in their work, there's no way anything would have got done.
So, yeah, I really don't think, I don't think our model of education is in any way effective with screens at that age. I think it's completely pointless.
What?
Like, I think the medium itself negates or increases more, adds more harm than good of whatever the person's learning.
Yeah, no, I agree completely.
Yeah. You know, I remember in grade 8, we were complaining about, I guess in grade 8, you're like 13 or so. And, you know, you got to get up, and class started at 8 a.m. Like, so you had to be there at like 10 to 8. And we were just having a hard time focusing. And our teacher told us of a study she had read. She was an elderly lady, Mrs. Wilby, and that theorized that kids should
age. To cut us off, but I got to go because I can't continue.
Oh, you got to go.
Yeah.
Your wife's calling you.
Yes, definitely.
I'll tell you this theory, this alternative theory of teenage education next time, brother. Say hi to your wife. Give my love.
Will do, my man. Good talking to you.
Peace, homie.
All right. Ciao. Man. Take care.
Bye.
Hermetic Science Enterprises is a publishing company based in Scotland, UK, that specializes in Western esoteric printed literature as well as educational videos. With various imprints under its belt, its roster consists of grimoire tradition literature, alchemical works, Golden Dawn tradition books, and the several texts and videos originally belonging to the philosophers of nature. Besides its downloadable videos and standard hardcover edition books, Hermetic Science Enterprises also produces beautiful and precious limited fine edition books that are true pieces of art. For more information to order any of its products, please visit www.hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. That's hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. And as a lot of you know, I've talked with the publisher Lenny on the podcast before, including a 6-hour epic extended version on the Patreon, and seen the fine edition of his new Grimoire of Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft, which is only available for purchase up to 50 limited copies till the end of May, I believe. So check it out now. HermeticScienceEnterprises.co.uk.